on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Yeah, coming up today, the slowest start to a raspberry harvest in almost three decades.
There's just been no warmth. There's been no sunshine. And so this is the latest season that I've seen in 28 years. I started this little business when I was 15 and I'm 42 now. So this is the latest season in 28 years.
And the new cellar door opened just in time for the summer season.
We are the furthest north cellar door in the Coal River Valley. So it will be a bit of a destination cellar door. And as a young brand, it'll be interesting to see what the reception is for it. But it's a gorgeous space.
Yeah, brand new cellar door in the Coal River Valley, open in time for the summer holiday season. We'll find out more in today's Country Hour. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Tuesday, where we also take you to the well-known Westaway Raspberry Farm in the Derwent Valley to find out how things are going with the new harvest. A little bit slow, the latest in around three decades due to the cooler weather. Also coming up today, the new head of the National Farmers Federation talks about any planned changes to gun controls following the terrorist attack at Bondi. That story for you in just a moment. We will check the latest on the weather in around about 10 minutes' time and take your thoughts via that text line. 0438 922 936 is that number. First up today, Australia's peak ag industry body, the National Farmers Federation, is calling for calm and considered firearms reform following the horrific attack at Bondi. In New South Wales, the Liberal Party has supported the state government's first bill in response to the Bondi terror attack, giving the legislation a pathway through both houses. The changes would see tighter gun laws, including restrictions on the number of firearms that someone can own and more frequent license checks. Meanwhile, the federal government will establish a national gun buyback scheme to purchase surplus guns, newly banned and illegal firearms, the largest since the Howard government's 1996 buyback. NFF President Hamish McIntyre tells Megan Hughes they don't want to see any legislation rushed through without proper consultation.
Farmers right across Australia were absolutely devastated by the events at Bondi and understand the community it puts safety as a high priority, and we do too. But at the same time, we just need to emphasise that firearms are an essential tool of trade for farmers right across Australia, but also people that live and work in our regional communities that help us control feral pests on our properties as required and when required. And we always will support sensible reform, but we just caution against doing anything in a rushed manner and heavy-handed changes that also can create unintended consequences for farmers. So we just want to reviews done sensibly and consider all things, but we need to understand that reforms were done back in the Howard era, you know, have been very effective for rural and regional Australia, we believe. So any changes going forward hopefully will be very minor for agriculture. It needs to be looked at separately to how firearms are, you know, managed and stored in our big cities around Australia.
So New South Wales, out of all the states, is the first one to put through reforms. Having a look at what they've done, which is limiting the number of firearms per person. The cap, though, is different from a regular person to a sport shooter or to a primary producer, and also extra conditions around storage and licensing. Are there any concerns at the moment of what that particular state is doing?
Look, we're still considering everything that they are considering, and we haven't seen the final details. So New South Wales obviously are the state due to the terrible murders that occurred there last Sunday, working more quickly on reform. So, look, when we see the absolute detail, and we might know more this afternoon, we will make further comment then, Megan. New South Wales Farmers Federation are working with the government, so hopefully the changes that do come forward have very minimal effect, if any effect, on farmers. But again, as I said, we do support sensible reform. If there's things that are shown out that we can live with farmers, I'm sure, you know, in the interest of the broader community safety, we'll be very, you know, open to considering them. But at the moment, we haven't got the final detail.
What does successful consultation with the agricultural industry look like to you?
That we are engaged in the process of reform and policy as it evolves. So as it's discussed, it's much easier for all to work collectively together as new legislation, new policy is developed, so that, you know, it's a win-win then for government and regional Australia. So it's about working closely together as it's created, I believe, is essential, just so we don't have politics getting in the road of what actually the community needs in this area.
Now, looking at the states, WA implemented some of the strictest controls in the country, I think it was last year. Have you heard from your member organisations in WA about whether there's been any issues since those reforms in the West?
Look, we have discussed it. They, at the time, were, you know, finding it difficult, but I think as it's evolved and as it's played out, some of the members have articulated to me that they do believe that they can work within those new guidelines. It's just depends. I mean, we all need to remember where you live and, you know, what you require firearms for. As we all know, I mean, we have to control pests, anything from rabbits and feral cats through to pigs, donkeys and camels, much larger animals. So we've got to have fit-for-purpose firearms to control these species when required. So a much smaller caliber rifles required to dispatch humanely a cat as compared to a pig or a wild donkey that's causing a lot of damage. So it's ensuring that where you are, that you are do have access to the right caliber firearms to control the species you need to produce food and fibre effectively. But also it's a biosecurity issue. I mean, we all understand, things like pigs, spread disease very quickly, and heat wave conditions we've been having in Western Queensland at the moment. I mean, we've been dispatching pigs out of holes and keeping cattle and sheep away from drinking there while they're wallowing in them. So it is really important that we can do it humanely, so we need the right weapon for the right situation.
Has the NFF reached out to the state governments to discuss these reforms that are being proposed?
Yes, look, we've opened dialogue with them, but it's, I've had a chat to our state agricultural minister, and look, they I believe approaching it very sensibly. Watch what's going on in other places, and then let's work through it together, in the coming months and get it right. It's a state-based legislation, so in Queensland, Ag Force will be working, front and centre with our state government. Ag Force are obviously a very important member to National Farmers Federation, so the state organisations will lead any changes or potential changes to policy in their states.
Have you identified any specific concerns of any of the reforms so far?
There's a lot of talk out there, Megan, so just access to the appropriate weapons, as you and I have discussed, and appropriate firearms, I should say, is the most important thing. And around whether we are reviewed as firearms license holders on a more regular basis, I think many in the community would agree with that. It's not in perpetuity, so people's situation changes in rural and regional Australia as it does in the city. So I think as long as it's not every year, maybe it's every 5 or 10 years that it's reviewed as we renew our licences, that's appropriate, I think. But as I said, I think the laws that Prime Minister Howard put in place all those years ago after that terrible tragedy, have been effective for rural and regional Australia. So very open to reform, but perhaps it just needs to be minor tweaks here and there.
National Farmers Federation President Hamish McIntyre speaking to Megan Hughes about any changes to gun laws, calling for calm and considered firearms reform. We will check the weather in just a moment.
You're amazing, Tasmania. The ABC Giving Tree has broken all records. You've raised more than $390,000 for Tasmanians in need this Christmas. From all of us at ABC Radio Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now to one of the most important segments in the Country Hour, and it's 80-year history, the weather, of course. And let's check the latest on the weather. Ursula Connor joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Ursula.
Good afternoon, Tony.
Any rainfall of any note?
We did have bit of a weak front pass over the state sort of last night. It brought most of the rain into sort of the elevated parts of the west coast, picking up around sort of 15 to 20 millimetres. Cradle Valley picked up 21. Elsewhere, we sort of saw around sort of 2 to 5 millimetres. A couple around the Hobart area. Noonamara picked up 4 near Launceston there. So few showers around, not much making it through to the east or very far northeast of the state though, Tony.
All right, inching closer to Christmas Day, what's the outlook?
Yeah, you're right. We're now currently in the sort of cooler and gusty westerly winds behind that front. So that's just bringing out a few showers mainly to the west and south of the state today. And as we move into tonight, we'll see northwesterly winds picking up ahead of a cold front, which will cross the state early tomorrow morning. So we'll briefly see showers extend statewide with that. Again, not too much expected to make it through to the far northeast of the state. But then behind that front, we will see westerly winds picking up quite strong. We could even see potential for damaging wind gusts up to 100 kilometres per hour tomorrow. So keeping an eye out for a severe weather warning coming out for large parts of sort of southern, western and even parts of northeastern Tassie into tomorrow. Those strong winds are also driving extreme fire dangers for the Furneaux Islands tomorrow. So we'll also have a fire weather warning coming out for that area this afternoon. And then that front is also bringing some cold air. So as well as the fire weather warning, we're going to see snow down to around 700 to 800 metres from sort of late Wednesday and even into the early hours of a Christmas morning, especially for that West Coast forecast district. But as we move into Friday, things are looking up. We do have a ridge of high pressure moving in over the state, so we'll start to see conditions settle down and those showers clearing up, temperatures starting to warm up again sort of by the end of the weekend and into early next week, Tony.
Yeah, those weather conditions won't worry Santa, will they?
No, I'm sure. I'm sure Santa and his reindeer will feel quite at home with the snow.
What sort of temperatures do we have at the moment?
At the moment, the warmest, sunny St. Helens, of course, 19 degrees at the moment. But elsewhere, pretty mild around the state, only 16 in Hobart, 18 in Lonnie, currently 17 in Devonport, 16 in Wynyard, and what are we in Strawn? 14 degrees in Strawn.
Oh, 14. And the expectations with regard to the temperature on Christmas Day in the major centres?
Yeah, we're looking quite chilly. We'll be temperatures around those sort of mid to maybe pushing high teens for large parts of the state. Showers about sort of the west and south of the state and still a little bit windy, but mainly just partly cloudy conditions through the north and northeast of the state, Tony.
So bringing out the puffer jacket again. Warnings, what have we got?
Yeah, at the moment we just have gale wind warnings current for southwestern waters. So that one extends from Tasman Island around to Sandy Cape for those westerly winds today. Strong wind warning current for all the remaining coastals, including the southeast inshores and the central plateau lakes. We also have a warning to sheep graziers for the Upper Derwent Valley and the southeast districts for today and tomorrow. And as I said, keeping an eye out for the severe weather warning for damaging winds tomorrow and the fire weather warning coming out tonight, Tony.
Okay, now Andrew's asked for the Wave Rider Boy maximums when you do the coastal waters and swell.
No worries. Well, at the moment in the winds, we're looking at westerlies 20 to 30 knots, more like 15 to 20 about the east coast. We will see those winds tend west to northwesterly later this afternoon and pick up to around 30 to 40 knots about the southwest. Into tomorrow, we'll see those westerlies at 25 to 35 knots extending throughout all the coastal waters and reaching up to 40 knots about the south. They'll start to tend southwesterly during the afternoon tomorrow. Swells in the west and south, we're looking at a west to southwesterly of 3 to 4 metres at the moment, building to 4 to 5 metres as we move into the afternoon and up to 5 to 6 tomorrow. Through the north, a westerly around 1 metre, picking up to 1 to 2 tomorrow. In the east, a southwesterly of 1 to 2 metres, building to 4 metres offshore in the south tomorrow. Okay, Sorrel Boy is currently sitting at 3.8 metres, a maximum wave height of 6.1. Mariah Island currently sitting at 1.1 with a max wave height of 1.6.
Beautifully done. Thank you, Ursula. You have a great Christmas.
Cheers, Tony. You too. Bye.
Thank you, Ursula Connor from the Bureau with the latest for you on the Country Hour. Now, if you want raspberries for Christmas, you'll have to get in quick just before the 25th as cool conditions have delayed the peak of harvest time in the state. A cold November with few sunny days has seen one of the state's biggest raspberry patches with fewer pre-Christmas raspberries this year. Westaway Raspberry Farm's Richard Clark spoke to Fiona Breen about the difficult season so far.
It's been a terribly cold October, November and first part of December. It's not unusual for us to have, you know, cold patches in that period, but normally the temperature rises and they bounce back and they catch up. There's just been no warmth. There's been no sunshine. And so this is the latest season that I've seen in 28 years. I started this little business when I was 15 and I'm 42 now. So this is the latest season in 28 years. And it's 3 weeks later than I've ever seen it. So it's,
wow.
It's pretty hard and pretty devastating when you know when you're a business that's set up to try and supply fresh berries into the pre-Christmas market when there's a fairly high demand from the public for fruit, and it's been really hard taking a lot of phone calls from disappointed customers because we just haven't had any raspberries.
Oh my goodness! So yeah. What's this doing to your marketing and your sales and?
So, I mean, fortunately, we're very diversified. We mechanically harvest a lot of our fruit. You know, we have lots of different avenues to market. So diversification's really, it means more work, but it is really critical in a year like this. So, but probably about 20% of our revenue comes from the week before Christmas for the year. And we'll be probably bringing in half of that this year. So, you know, luckily, we're not totally leveraged towards the week before Christmas, but it does...
It would be a big winner for a business like yours.
It is. And we do gear our business towards that week of Christmas. There's really strong demand for berries for the Christmas table, I suppose, in Tasmania each year. But and then after Christmas, people tend not to go to the supermarket as much after Christmas because they've got all those leftovers and their fridges are full. So, you know, after Christmas, the market and the price comes down significantly for berries. And so missing that pre-Christmas window does compromise, some of your sales and some of your higher value sales that you make for the year.
So that will affect the bottom line.
It will. But again, we've got lots of avenues to market. And the good news is that the sun did come out last week. The berries that are, the plants that have just been waiting and waiting and waiting to start producing some red fruit, because they want to produce red fruit just as much as I want them to. But they've started fruiting. So, I mean, today we've got 35 pickers. Last year we would have had 70 pickers working for the last 3 or 4 days in the lead up to Christmas. Yesterday I only had 10 pickers. The day before I had 5 pickers. Today I've got 35 pickers. So we are starting to see them come on. We are going to get some small punnets into the market before Christmas. Normally we have value packs or family packs in the market before Christmas, and Tasmanians love those. But this year, it's only possible to try and stretch out the small amount of raspberries that we've got by offering, the supermarket 125-gram punnets. That being said, as soon as Christmas passes, and, on the 27th, we'll have fruit coming out our ears, and so we'll be back into family packs and value packs, and pick your own will be back open. And so things will happen. It's just that they're not happening before Christmas.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? We've just had a little bit of warm weather, but I think we're going cool again around Christmas.
We are. Normally, that's actually a really fantastic thing. My big little brother Tom and I often pray for rain and cold conditions over Christmas because it just means that the fruit stops ripening a little bit and it doesn't get away from us because we normally have a couple of days off with the two public holidays. So cold weather over Christmas normally wouldn't be a bad thing. This year we would still like, we actually still need the raspberries to get kicked into gear a little bit. So it's less than ideal, but again, we won't be picking for a couple of days. And by the time we come back on Saturday the 27th, there should be a nice number of raspberries by that stage, even with the cooler conditions.
Now, I know we just talked about the numbers, but again, do you think you'll still produce as much as you have in previous years, or these cooler sort of November, et cetera, affect what your total numbers?
That's a great question, Fiona. No, so I think our raspberries, so we've had really good pollination. The crop's looking wonderful. The farm's actually never looked neater. We've just been trying to find jobs for people to do over the last 2 or 3 weeks. So the crop's there, and it's just about the distribution. So I studied economics, and there's normal distributions. There's left and right skewed distributions. The distribution of a berry harvest changes from year to year. And so what we'd normally have is a nice long lead in to a season before the peak. I think this year we're going to have a fairly short lead in, and then the berries are all going to come at once. Depending, we'll have a longer season and a later season, as long as January is not super hot. But if January becomes super hot, then I reckon all our raspberries are just going to fruit at once, and we'll be done and dusted in a really record short amount of time. So it's very much in the hands of the gods and the weather, but we'll just react. And again, luckily we're diversified enough with the mechanical harvesting that we'll find some silver lining somewhere in this funny season.
Yes, that's why the weather forecasts are so important for the farmers. Westaway Raspberries Farms, Richard Clark, chatting to Fiona Breen about the late start to the harvest for the fruit because of the weather. And the weather has also affected cherry crops in the Huon Valley, although there are early varieties in the market. Main crops are at least a week late this year. Grower Matt Griggs spoke to Fiona.
The season on the whole has been definitely later than we are used to. The November soil temperatures were about 2 degrees lower than the previous year, which makes quite a big difference with how trees, I guess, develop through the season. And then also on the back of the wettest November on record, it's been quite a challenging growing season. But fruit's looking good on the tree so far, but we're definitely late by probably a week or two.
You reckon about a week or a week and a half behind what might normally be your start of picking?
Yes. So normally we would be starting our main cherry harvest at the end of December, but now it's looking more like towards the end of the first week of January. So, definitely at least a week or more behind.
And do you actually measure soil temps?
Yes, we measure soil temps on site, and that's what we found.
You found that they're still a bit cooler.
Definitely cooler than last year. Yeah.
In terms of the lead up, when you've had blossom, etc., how's all that gone? Are you expecting good numbers?
So the spring was definitely a very challenging spring. So with the cooler temperatures, high rainfall, there's been a little bit of variability in fruit set. So some of our earlier yielders are quite light on for fruit, and then some of our later maturing blocks are quite good for fruit set. And the mid-season, where we were expecting very big crops, they've sort of come back to average or normal, which is generally it's a nice crop. We should get pretty decent sized fruit and good flavour, so it's a pretty good outcome, all things considered.
So how will this affect the bottom line?
I think our volumes might be slightly down on what we were expecting for this year, but they'll still be up on last year. But that's mainly due to young blocks coming on rather than trees yielding high amounts of fruit.
By young blocks, you mean new trees?
Yeah. So we had a fairly big planting, 4 years ago, and so we've got a few blocks that are coming on now with earlier varieties and also more mid-season varieties as well. So that's going to help our total volume for sure.
So what's your main variety at the moment that you're growing?
Like most Tasmanian farms, Lappin is still the biggest volume cherry that we grow. It is a good variety. It does suit our climate down here in the Huon. We can get it fairly large in size and get the sugar levels that are required, and we can, with a bit of work, we can get them nice and firm and crunchy, and they're a very well known, I guess, variety in the Asian market. Yeah, it's kind of like the base or the foundation of the Tasmanian cherries, that's for sure.
What should Tasmanians, for a start, be looking out for in the next few weeks? What sort of varieties?
The varieties that are coming through for us, we've just finished the Royal Tioga, and then we've got a few Royal Dawns that are coming through, and I believe some other farms are picking some Chelan. There'll be some Santina coming up, and then we'll be going into majority of farms. We'll be starting into Lapins after that.
And so that'll be after Christmas in the new year sometime for the Lapins?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so Lapins will be, you know, first week of January. In the Huon anyway, I'd say some of the, you know, perhaps in the Derwent, there might be some Lapins coming out, you know, earlier, you know, maybe end of December.
And which one do the export markets like?
Lapins is pretty, it's a mainstay, Lapins. And then there's, you know, we do grow quite a bit of Regina as well, which is a good later season variety. And then, you know, some Staccato is a good one as well. But the majority of fruit that's exported out of Tasmania is a Lapin or sort of variant of Lapin.
And so does it help that Chinese New Year is later in February?
Yeah, the yeah, everything's lining up really well. Yeah, mid-Feb for Chinese New Year, and we're, you know, tracking, you know, a little bit later. So I think the timing is going to be very good for us, which is fortunate. Yeah, we're very lucky. It's not an early Chinese New Year, as it could be quite a disaster for us. So very, very happy about that.
And how are you going with workers?
So far, so good. We've got most of our picking crew is seasonal, the Pacific Islanders now, so we've sort of organising that ahead of schedule. Some are here already, and we're picking raspberries and the early cherries and pruning and thinning and whatnot. So we've got a base crew, and we'll add to that as the season progresses. It seems like there's a lot of casuals and backpackers and students looking for work at the moment. No doubt they'll all disappear at some stage through the season as they find work. But at the moment, there's certainly a lack of work in that sort of casual labour space.
So have you had to put people off a bit because the cherries are a little bit later?
No, we did delay some of our Pacific Islanders starting. So we did delay them by a week or so.
And you were able to do that?
Yeah, there's some flexibility in the program. But now, like, everyone's working flat out. We've got heaps to do.
Cherry grower Matt Griggs talking to Fiona Breen about the cherry harvest in the Huon Valley. Coming up, we'll visit the newest cellador in the state and a survey of feedlots for cattle and the shade offered for the cattle. First up, though, the news headlines with Loretta Loberger.
Good afternoon, Tony. The Prime Minister says he regrets the politicisation that has occurred in the wake of the Bondi terrorist attack. Since the tragedy unfolded more than a week ago, the opposition has been critical of the government's efforts to prevent anti-Semitism in the lead-up to the attack, as well as its response in the aftermath. Police are calling for information following two serious crashes in Hobart yesterday evening. The first was between a white SUV and a white sedan at the intersection of Davey and Mole Streets, about a quarter past five, and the second happened on the Brooker Highway near Granton between a red sedan and a white utility about half past five. Tasmania's salmon industry says initial testing for antibiotic residue proves waterways are safe despite the use of a new drug. The industry received emergency approval to use fluorphenicol last month following a mass mortality event last summer that killed millions of fish. A new report by the EPA has tested hundreds of sediment, water and wild fish samples from sites where the antibiotic is being used and says the environmental risk is low. And the United Nations Secretary General says Israel must lift all restrictions on the entry of building materials into Gaza. Recent flooding caused by torrential rain has increased destruction in Gaza, where many are living in tents or makeshift shelters as a result of Israel's bombardment. More news at 1 o'clock.
A bushfire survival plan is where you have written out what you will do before, during and after a fire. Find more suggestions on how to develop and what to include in your plan at abc.net.au/emergency.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, there aren't too many vineyards in the state that grow, make and sell their wine on site. Sisu Wines in the Coal River Valley recently joined the Select Club, opening a new cellar door on the outskirts of Campania. Sophie Jaggers spoke to winemaker Jake Sheedy about juggling several roles and increasing biodiversity on farm.
There's lots of challenges. I guess it's wearing many hats and juggling many things at the one time, but there's also a lot of benefits as far as quality control and then also getting to really work backwards as far as winemaking style can be dictated in the vineyard, where normally it would be very difficult to have that type of control if you were, you know, buying fruit.
2024 was your first vintage. What's the reception been like?
It's really positive. We've had really, really warm reviews through Halliday and Wine Pilot. So that's been really, really good. It's a nice bit of encouragement to keep on, and the hard work is paying off. Just released the Riesling and Rosé, and they're looking good, and we're about to bottle the 25 Chardonnay Pinot and Syrah Viognier, which will be coming out soon as a cellar door only. And that's looking like the wine of vintage, so very exciting.
And your cellar door is opening just as we're coming into the Christmas season. What kind of reception are you anticipating?
I have no idea. I hope a good one. We are the furthest north cellar door in the Coal River Valley, so it will be a bit of a destination cellar door. And as a young brand, it'll be interesting to see what the reception is for it, but it's a gorgeous space, a really nice spot for a tasting as well as a cheese board or a charcuterie board, and just enjoy this lovely weather we have. So, yeah, I guess we'll see, but yeah, hopefully busy.
And it's been a bit of a cool and windy spring. Is that likely to affect this upcoming harvest?
Yeah, I think so. It's really interesting. We're phenologically at the same stage as, last year. We're about on track for flowering. However, our growth rate is maybe 3 weeks behind. We just don't have any shoot length right now, and that will make it interesting for next vintage, just as far as pruning is concerned. We're going through and we're dropping a lot of shoots right now because I'm concerned that being a cooler year, we might struggle to actually get things ripe. So just trying to be mindful of that and proactive, and that might hopefully pay some dividends come March.
I've heard rewilding is something you're also interested in. Can you tell me about your partnership with Landcare?
Yeah, so we've done I'd like to get 10% of the farm done. We've done a 4-hectare development with Landcare, which was really, really good, and Wildlands conjunction with them as well. We have just got approval, I think, for a dam enhancement project as well. So we'll be doing that next year. So the plan is to kind of, every year, every second year, to do another little bit of the farm. We're just planting, obviously, natives, mostly white gums, black wattles, she oaks, and then poa grasses, some prickly box as well. So just trying to increase biodiversity on the farm as much as possible, particularly on areas that, can't really be utilised for grape production.
Are there many benefits of rewilding for viticulture?
Yeah, so interestingly, prickly box actually has a predatorial mite that eats mites on grapevines, so you can actually use less or no insecticide if you have a healthy prickly box population around. There is like a direct benefit for that, but more importantly, just having more insects around, you just like a healthier system. The dirt's healthier and therefore more active. It can utilize its carbon that's like naturally found in these black dolerite soils with the self-mulching black cracking clay, and you get a better carbon nitrogen ratio. It's just, if it's alive, it's going to be a much healthier system.
Was it always a winery?
It was a sheep farm beforehand, so they were running about 200-250 crossbred ewes, and then the occasional cash crop like poppies or barley or something. So we're still running sheep here, so for holistic farming practices. So we lamb in the vineyard blocks in winter, which is really good, and then we can utilize other paddocks during the summer when the vines are growing for sheep feed, which is really good.
I guess on the soil as well, was there any regeneration required for you to establish a vineyard here?
No, so naturally it was incredibly fertile, great soil. Like our organic matter is 9%, You know, I worked in Burgundy a couple of years ago, and they were really proud of themselves because the industry average was 0.3%, and the winery I was working for was 3.0%, and you know, they were proud as punch. And then when they asked me what we had, and I told them, they were like, "That's surely impossible." But that's not due to active effort by us necessarily. It's just, I guess, the nature of that black self-mulching cracking clay. And then we're mindful of it. So we undervine cultivate to reduce herbicide use. However, if you do that too much, you can break soil structure. And so it's a really fine line. So we actually do both just to try and minimize any damage.
And how many grapes went into your first vintage?
So in our first vintage, we just did three wines. So we did a Pinot Noir, Chardonnay and Riesling. In 25, we did another Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Riesling, a Rosé, Syrah Viognier, and two sparklings, a Blanc de Blanc and a Blanc de Noir. The sparklings have been terraged. The Blanc de Blanc will probably come out in, I don't know, 4 years, and the Blanc de Noir may make it out for next summer, but we'll wait and see. It's a bit of a patience game with those.
And Vineyard saw a great harvest last year. Are you anticipating similar results coming into the next season?
I think so. Like, as far as I can see, the fruitfulness is looking great. Flowering is really kicking off now, and the wind is dropping out, and the bunch numbers are really, really high. So it could well be just as good as last year, which would be crazy considering the number of hectares that are coming online that we'll be producing for the first time.
Yes, Jake Sheedy, owner of Sisu Wines at Campania, talking to Sophie Jaggers about the new cellar door and the biodiversity on farm. Well, talking about that, droughts, floods and pests have remained fundamental threats to Australian farming since the Country Hour's inception in 1945, indeed well before that. But today they're even more complex with shifts in geopolitics, trade wars and a changing climate. Many producers are rethinking how they work the land, not just to get through to the next season, but to protect the next generation, as Taylor Larson reports.
A delicate ecosystem hides at the back of a Bundaberg cattle property, 4 hours north of Brisbane. The 40-hectare mangrove forest lines the banks of the Elliot River, which flows towards the southern Great Barrier Reef. Around 50 species of shorebirds call these wetlands home, as do more than a dozen bulls. This unlikely combination is intentional. For the past 4 years, Jack Milbank has been using cattle to help restore vegetation and has eliminated almost all of the noxious weeds.
You can see this is all new established mangrove that's been transmitted there through having cattle, controlled graze, marine cooch that's gone to seed, and then they'll wander out and browse mangroves and then deposit that seed and it'll start to germinate.
Jack's also streamlined his commercial cattle operations, establishing an African genetics breeding program to produce animals that perform in harsh conditions. Controlling weeds and improving his genetics are just a couple of ways he's been adapting to climate change.
The threat is on food security, and so it's beholden upon us as producers to breed adapted cattle that handle longer, hotter, drier spells, that are more feed efficient on grass, less reliant on synthetic inputs. Those are all just little steps that we can take towards climate insurance or climate resilience.
The increase in regenerative farming has been documented throughout Country Hour conversations. Experts say farmers' attitudes have shifted in the past two decades. The Millennium Drought and Black Saturday bushfires were confronting wake-up calls.
When you think about growing a crop, you need about 6 months of relatively benign weather. You don't want a flood, you don't want a frost, you don't want fire, you don't want a drought. So all these different things that come along make it very difficult to continue to grow crops.
That's Farmer Outreach Officer Peter Holding from advocacy group Farmers for Climate Action. The organisation's latest survey found 9 in 10 respondents faced extreme weather in the past 3 years, while 57% of those surveyed believe climate change is the greatest risk to Australian agriculture.
It used to take about a generation or 30 years to bring about a change on a farm from the science laboratory or the trial site or whatever. It takes about 12 months now. I mean, the farmers quite often are implementing what the researchers are discovering or doing before they've even written their reports. you know, they're that closely connected.
Producers are adapting their business models to offset potential losses from weather extremes, and they're looking to the Country Hour for guidance to keep across new trends and emissions targets.
The whole ag spectrum is amplified through Country Hour. It's I think, really important blend of the tradition and introduction of new ways of doing things and keeping people informed and engaged in their industry.
This is a great harvest because you can see...
Janelle Gerry is the managing director of Macadamias Australia. Her parents began cultivating land in 1958 and the Country Hour quickly became a staple in their home.
Listening to the Country Hour, listening to those market reports, listening to those interviews across different industries was so helpful for us to see what's on trend, make decisions about our future. So also, it also stimulated great discussion over the lunch table.
Nuts from the family's orchard are now sold throughout Australia, as well as parts of Asia, the US and the Middle East. The family credits its success to working with the land.
Even choosing between trickle irrigation and sprinkler irrigation can make a big difference to, you know, how the roots are developed. So, you know, knowing that, you know, we are in a cyclone area, having roots that are spread is very important. So actually sprinkler irrigation is best for macadamias here.
Sustainability goes beyond the orchard. Like many farming families, they've diversified to future-proof their offerings. Macadamias Australia has grown to include a value-adding facility, visitor centre and an on-site cafe.
Agritourism has become a sector in itself because it gives farmers that diversified income. So if something doesn't go so well on their farms, then they've got other income streams to consider. But also it's a wonderful way to connect the consumer with the farms.
Similar to the generations before them, the family's Country Hour discussions are continuing today as the younger members of the business prepare to leave their own mark in a more eco-conscious world.
It's Taylor Larson reporting, and you can catch more of that story on iView through Landline. And there's
cricket on. Boxing Day cricket returns with the fourth Ashes test between Australia and England. Hear every ball of the cricket all summer long.
The Ashes.
On 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
We're talking feedlots now, and Queensland feedlots are leading the nation when it comes to shading cattle. Tasmania trails the field with no change since 2020. A new report from the Australian Lot Feeders Association shows 81% of cattle in Queensland feedlots now have access to shade. That's a big jump from 62% back in 2020. ALFA President Grant Kerry says it's a voluntary move that's paying off, improving animal welfare, productivity and reputation.
We've made great progress. We're up to over 1.3 million head of cattle now with shade, and that's up from 800,000 head back in 2020. So, you know, today we're at 75% of constructed capacity with shade for cattle in feedlots across Australia.
Queensland is leading the way in this initiative. How is it going?
Certainly, Queensland's leading the way with in the terms of percentage. It's also got the most cattle on feed. We're up to just under 82% now of cattle on feed in Queensland with access to shade, and that's grown by over 300,000 head since 2020. So it's been a big effort by lot feeders in Queensland.
So looking at the other states, New South Wales is up to 74%. Of cattle having access to shade. Victoria is on 61%, South Australia 53%, WA 39% and Tasmania 30%. What's behind the differences in uptake? Do we know why Queensland's leading the way?
You know, it's a hotter climate and probably more conducive to having shade installed in the hotter climates where it sort of started, and then it's certainly starting to grow and be used more as well in some of the more southern areas.
So putting up shade is a voluntary initiative, and I'd imagine it would be quite expensive. Why are feedlots installing more shade?
Yeah, look, people are installing shade for animal welfare reasons to help manage cattle during, you know, heat load events. It certainly brings with it some animal welfare benefits and productivity benefits as well, especially in those difficult climatic conditions. We've seen a lot of R&D in this space over many years that's been done with MLA and Alpha through levy funding. And we've seen, a lot of trials over that time that have shown performance benefits. We see benefits like, feed intake being maintained through hot weather. And we're seeing those sort of things that are really, coming to the fore and allowing people to go ahead and make the investments to put shade in.
In the latest Meat and Livestock Australia shade research, cattle with access to shade were found to have an increase in weight gain of 0.13 kilograms per head per day over the summer period. Now, this equated to an extra 11 kilos of live weight or 6 kilos of carcass weight. Are those numbers significant?
Any sorts of gains that we can get in average daily gain are significant to the bottom line in feeding cattle, so it's certainly providing some good results.
So the northern cattle industry, Queensland, Northern Territory and Northern WA, is dominated by Bos Indicus breeds like Brahman, while the southern cattle industry, New South Wales, Victoria, Tasmania, South Australia and Southern WA, is dominated by Bos Taurus breeds like Angus. Does the colour or hardiness of cattle play a role in all of this?
We see certainly the benefits of shade across, all different climatic conditions, even in the south. The hot weather, certainly on the Angus cattle, we see the benefits. And then again, even through central Queensland, we're seeing a lot of feedlots seeing benefits of shade on some of those more Bos Indicus content cattle are still seeing some benefit.
What is the goal for this initiative? Where do you want to be in 5 or 10 years' time?
Certainly from an industry point of view, we'd like to see all cattle with access to shade over time, and we'll continue to work with lot feeders and do R&D to help underpin lot feeders continuing to install shade where they haven't yet got to do so.
Now, a lot of this work has been done within the industry. Do you think that is enough, or should there be some sort of outside, sort of independent verification?
Yeah, look, Alpha and MLA work really closely together on the feedlot R&D program, and we've had a great relationship working with them for a long time now in this R&D space, and a huge amount of that work's been done around shade and shelter research. And a lot of that research is done by independent universities and other people. So, we've got real confidence in the way that we do the R&D, that it is actually driving results that we can rely on and use across industry to go out and make these changes.
Do these sorts of projects improve public perception of the feedlot industry?
I think that's shown in the Alpha Shade Initiative report that's available on the website, and it shows that concerns about beef production within a feedlot have declined consistently over the last sort of 10 or 12 years. And I think a lot of that's been driven by the focus of the industry to do things like installing shade and making, looking after the cattle and making sure the animal welfare's right in what we do every day.
That's Grant Gehry, President of the Australian Lot Feeders Association, speaking to Brandon Long about the latest survey. When it comes to shading cattle, the report says only 30% of cattle have access to shade in Tasmanian feedlots, no change from 2020. Well, an entire ocean separates Rosina Mana from her four children in Vanuatu, but she finds comfort gathering with fellow Pacific workers who've made similar sacrifices to come to Australia to work in agriculture. The group gathers every Sunday to celebrate their faith. As Johanna Marie reports, the sermon is more about spending time in the community and finding joy while they're living 2,000 kilometres away from home. Love is the key.
Walking along the footpath beside Queensland's Elliott Heads Beach, it's easy to be drawn in by this cheerful voice. Intrigued beachgoers carrying paddleboards and towels watch as a woman in a red dress dances and claps to the music. Her name is Rosina Mana.
I'm from Vanuatu, the island of Tana, small island in Tana, from the south of Vanuatu.
Rosina is a cleaner at Farmgate Backpackers East Bundaberg Hostel. There she earns $1,000 a week, much more than she could make in her home country.
I'm here since 5th of November 2023, mm-hmm. and I'm still here.
You have come to Australia to make money and provide for your family. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I'm a single mother. My husband died 2013 and left me with 4 kids. And I struggle with them back home. But and then I made up my mind. I saw people coming to Australia and they went back and they helped their families. And me too, I want to help my families through their school fees and our food, providing for our shelter. And it makes me, my heart really wants to come over.
Jules Ramsey manages the hostel but is also the workers' support person. She organised a generator through the local Rotary Club so the workers could take this special service outdoors.
Just being around them is just this, like for me, it's just an uplifting experience, you know. You can see that they're just so happy. They have so little at home and they just seem to find joy in everything. And, you know, I think for us, we get caught in that trap of having to have more and do more and be more. And they really have taught me so much just to slow down and enjoy what's in front of you. I just love being around them. I just love, yeah, I love how I feel. And when they sing, it just makes my heart so full, you know. I really just, I love being with them, so...
Is it also about getting them out in the community?
So it's really, really, really important for them to be in the community. I think they spend so much of their time here. They're here, the majority of them. Even the short-term visa holders are here for 9 months of the year, and then they go home for 3 months, and then they come back. So it's really hard for them to fit anywhere. Like, you know, they have their families at home and often they go home and make a baby and then come back, and then the next 9 months are spent here working and away from their family, away from their friends. And then because they're not from here, they find it hard to put roots down here.
Do you think there's enough support in Australia for their mental health? And
absolutely not. Like, particularly in big regions like this where we're so dependent on them and they bring so much to our community. And like what I said before, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be eating, you know. And I think that they need to be recognised for that. And it's a monetary thing, yes, and they get paid, you know, they're all under improved employers and they get paid properly. But it's more that mental health, the more that feeling of being accepted and being part of something and being made to feel special.
In October, there was almost 32,000 workers participating in the PALM scheme nationally. Most are from Vanuatu, followed by Fiji, and more than half are employed in the agriculture industry. Another worker, Eric Pong, says it can be hard to adjust to life here initially.
Yeah, definitely. It's not an easy choice to make, to leave your families, but just to make it a quick response for the family back home. We have to sacrifice ourselves to come over just to work hard, and our family have to benefit on what we are doing back in Australia.
Eric and Rosina say they've both fallen in love with Australia and Bundaberg and are grateful to be employed under the PALM scheme. In the meantime, when she's not working, you'll find Rosina dancing at the beach.
I'm feeling good. My heart is very happy for what we are doing. And I'm rejoicing in the program, what we're doing. I'm enjoying.
What does it mean to you to come together?
I feel in my heart like every day I'm working in the hostel as a cleaner. And I just want me alone there, but when we go out with my friends, so we happy hugging each other, talking and sharing books and like something like that. It makes me really happy. Love is the key.
Yeah, that report from Johanna Marie on the Palm Scheme workers and how they celebrate faith and friendship while working in our country and their country as well. Now, the Tasmanian government has published development guidelines for a sardine fishery in 2024. It's now developed a Tasmanian sardine fishery policy paper that sets the path towards a commercial sardine fishery. So if you wish to have a look at that policy paper, go to the Fishing Tasmania website and it's there for you to look at. That's our Country Hour for today. We will catch you again after midday tomorrow.